This is KFSK's Midday Magazine for Friday, July 29th. I'm Angela Dunning. A bill that puts local school boards in charge of sex education will become a law after Governor Bill Walker decided against vetoing it yesterday. House Bill 156 requires that school boards approve any sex education curriculum, as well as any teachers who aren't employed under contract with schools. The bill also allows parents to opt their children out of any lesson. It also gives parents the right to review sex education curriculum and teachers' credentials. And it bars the state from requiring school districts to administer standardized tests for 2 years unless the federal government threatens to withhold money. A regional group that looks at how to spend secure rural school funding is meeting in Petersburg tomorrow. The group is known as RAC, the Resource Advisory Committee, made up of 15 volunteers from Petersburg, Wrangell, and Cake. Their job is to make recommendations for using Title II funds coming through Secure Rural Schools Act. It's federal money that goes to communities for special projects that benefit national forest resources. Linda Slatt is the RAC coordinator. She told me that there are a lot of local projects that have been funded through RAC.
This funding has been used previously to support Banana Point, Greens Camp, Wilson Creek Picnic Area, Sandy Beach. Those are all recreation developments that are near the National Forest. In some cases, help provide activities that supplement National Forest recreation opportunities.
Now, you named a lot of parks and areas that are well known here near Petersburg. So specifically, what happened at those places?
Well, there were upland improvements at Banana Point. The parking area was expanded. New vault toilet was put in. Wilson Creek was really upgraded. It was kind of a neglected picnic site, very nice location, and it was expanded, and new picnic sites were added to that. And, of course, if you've been out to Greens Camp, the borough's been working on that kind of in partnership with PIA for many years now, and that former state campground had been neglected for many years, and they've brought that back to very fine condition, and it may be, one of the most popular recreation sites on the island now.
Those kind of sound like big dollar projects. Mm-hmm. What kind of amounts are we talking about that RAC usually deals with?
Well, one thing about this Title II money is it has been kind of on a downward glide path for many years, and so we've been seeing reductions. What our committee has available at this point is about $475,000. That covers the communities of Petersburg, Wrangell, and Cake. So we have representatives from all three communities on this committee.
And is that an annual amount?
No, this year we received a little over $300,000. And in addition to that, we had some earlier funds that have yet to be distributed. So combining 2 years' worth of funding.
That's what RAC is considering now, 2 years' worth of funds?
Yes.
All right, so what are some of the projects that you're considering now?
Well, the committee is meeting Saturday for the first time in 2 years. We haven't had a chance to really have the committee review new proposals that have just come in. But I can tell you we have about 20 new proposals for them to review, and the vast majority of them are recreation projects, trails, cabins, mostly.
Now, out of those 20 proposals, can you give us a few examples of projects for Petersburg?
Many of the projects continue projects that have been previously funded, such as Forest Service cabin improvements. Wrangell has, their most popular cabin is the Middle Ridge Cabin on Wrangell Island, and they have a proposal to improve the area near the cabin. We have a proposal from Petersburg to support the Kadake Bay Cabin firewood supply. We have a proposal for survey and design for replacing the Braylon Slough Cabin and further improvements at the Cachetes Lake Cabin. We've got a proposal for survey and design to improve the Cathedral Falls Trail out of Cake. You may be familiar with the improvements at Blackery Point, which is down on the south end of the island. There is a proposal to provide some signing at that new site, which includes a picnic area, for information on the Stikine LeConte Wilderness Area. I think because the committee hasn't met in 2 years, it's sort of like starting over, starting fresh. We have several new committee members that will be meeting Saturday, and so, you know, there will be discussion about what their priorities and interests are. In addition to that, we do have 11 committee members whose terms are going to be expiring the end of September.
So most of those terms are up come September?
Yes, we have 11 members who've served on the committee for several years. You can serve on the committee for up to 6 years, and so they will be terming out. And the approval process can take several months, actually, and so we are accepting applications for committee members kind of on an ongoing basis, but we will be submitting nomination packages pretty soon so that we can try to reestablish a full committee in the fall.
Linda Slatt is the RAC coordinator. RAC is meeting at the U.S. Forest Service's District Office Conference Room from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. tomorrow. It's open to the public and will be teleconferenced with the Wrangell Ranger District. There's a public comment period during the meeting that runs from 10 to 11 a.m. Southeast gardeners can apply for federal money for conservation projects. It's through the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service's High Tunnel Cost Share Program. High tunnels, or hoop houses, are structures used to extend the growing season. They are typically at least 6 feet tall in the center and differ from greenhouses in that they are passively heated by the sun. Samia Savelle is with NRCS's Juneau Field Office. She says programs funded through her department must support conservation projects, and high tunnels have conservation benefits.
They can help you make watering more efficient. They can reduce the need for nutrient inputs, especially here in Southeast where we have typically high precip. You can really tend to leach the nutrients out of your soil. So having a covered or controlled environment can make that a lot more efficient and beneficial for your crops as well. And it can reduce the need for pesticide inputs and control some kinds of pests.
She says another benefit is the encouragement of local food production. Savelle says anyone in Southeast who is currently growing crops, whether personally or commercially, can apply. Applicants must fill out forms, and both the landowner and land must meet certain eligibility requirements. She adds that because this is a federally funded program, crops must be legal under federal law.
There's a lot of new changes. I imagine our jobs will change significantly if some things are legalized on the federal level, but for now we're sticking with food or fiber or flowers.
Will Murray is also with NRCS. He says after an application is approved and a contract signed, the client must purchase an approved high tunnel kit.
The customers will, you know, order the kits, build the structure, and as they near completion, notify us. We will come out and certify the practices built according to the specifications and process a payment. Usually within a couple of weeks.
The deadline to file for the High Tunnel Cost Share Program is September 1st, but Savelle says people interested in applying should contact the Juneau Field Office by August. She says people need to verify their eligibility prior to submitting the application, and that takes some time. While the deadline for the program is fast approaching, Savelle says NRCS funds are other conservation projects throughout the year.
But also we help people with things like nutrient management and irrigation water management and a variety of different practices that can be beneficial not only for growing food or flowers, but also just for conserving natural resources.
Those interested in learning more about the services offered by NRCS can contact the Juneau Field Office. That number is 907-586-7220. We also have links posted on our website. Stockholders in Virgin America have approved the acquisition of their airline by Alaska Airlines. The chairman of Virgin America announced the voting results at a brief shareholders meeting this week. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonzi says this is the next-to-last major hurdle for the airline takeover.
The remaining hurdle is U.S. Justice Department approval. Antitrust regulators are already scrutinizing the proposed combination of the nation's 6th and 11th largest airlines. The feds could require the combined carriers to shed assets to preserve competition. Alaska Airlines management insists the result of its acquisition of Virgin America would be pro-consumer. Filings to the Justice Department point out the two carriers compete head-to-head on only a handful of routes, which happen to include Seattle and Portland to San Francisco.
Alaska Airlines and Virgin America's leaders both say they expect the deal to close by the end of this year. In April, Seattle-based Alaska Air won a bidding war for its smaller San Francisco-based rival with an offer of $2.6 billion. That represented a significant premium over Virgin America's stock price at that time. Alaska Airlines executives have not yet explained whether the hip Virgin America brand will survive once the two airlines are combined. Alaska Air Group CEO Brad Tilden said last week that he expects a decision to be reached early next year. While passing the west side of Juneau's Shelter Island on Wednesday, an 18-passenger tour vessel saw more than whales. Audrey Benson is a naturalist with the Gastineau Guiding Company. She was on the tour when the crew heard some news over the radio.
And we heard that there were two deer that were swimming across in the water. And so after we had watched the whales for a bit, our passengers were curious and wanted to see the deer. And so we motored over to them, and it turned out there was only one.
And it was struggling to stay above water. After a larger tour boat tried to rescue the animal a few times, it gave up. But Benson, along with the passengers and crew, decided to keep trying. They were eventually able to lasso the deer and pull it onto the boat.
The deer was immediately really bewildered and disoriented, and it was shaking a lot. It was shivering. Its teeth were chattering. It tried to stand up, but it collapsed because it was so weak.
The crew was able to drop the deer off at Shelter Island, but not before it tried to swim back into the water again.
It was the craziest thing that I have ever seen on any of my tours. I mean, you never know what's going to happen out there, but for a deer rescue, I've never even been that close to a deer. I've never touched one. And to have an opportunity to assist this struggling animal, it was very intense.
The other deer disappeared before the group reached it and is presumed to have drowned. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game says it's very uncommon for a deer to drown, adding that deer regularly swim from island to island. A University of Alaska professor is trying to develop a region-wide approach to monitoring wild foods. Dr. Todd O'Hara has been coming to Southeast Alaska for years to work with tribal organizations and other agencies to coordinate tissue sampling out of his lab in Fairbanks. Now he'd like to help these same agencies in Sitka, Hoonah, and Angoon put together a more local food safety system. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports from Sitka.
It's already in place for shellfish, a resource that requires constant monitoring to detect biotoxins that could have immediate health consequences for someone digging clams at a local beach, for instance. But what about that halibut or rockfish or that harbor seal, which is an important part of the diet in some southeast villages? Before we go any further, Todd O'Hara says don't let anything he's about to say discourage you from your diet of traditional foods. You're already doing the right thing.
The nutritional benefits greatly outweigh any possible risks. The thing that I fear most as a public health expert is that people will stop eating marine-derived foods for the wrong reasons.
Still, despite its remote location, Alaska doesn't get a free pass on toxic substances in the environment. They can move here in the air, in the water, and inside the living bodies of animals. O'Hara says it's important to keep an eye on what's getting into Alaska's food web.
Some of these things have been in our foods for millennia. They are naturally occurring. And so we know we've adapted to the presence of those. And so when we measure those, we're more or less just seeking reassurance that they're not increasing due to our activities. Then there's other chemicals that are just outright from human activities. For example, the chlorination of pulp, the burning of fossil fuels. Those come from human activities, and some of those chemicals are unique. So when we see those, we know they originated from human industry or human activities. For example, PCBs, DDT, those are manufactured by people and released to the environment.
O'Hara is a doctor of veterinary medicine and holds a PhD in pharmacology and toxicology. When he's not overseeing the veterinary medicine program at UAF, he's often down in Southeast, pulling together partners who would be willing to collaborate on a project with the National Institutes of Health to localize the monitoring of marine-based foods. So far, the Huna Indian Association and Sitka Tribe of Alaska are on board. The STA recently opened an environmental research lab to monitor for biotoxins in shellfish. O'Hara says the next step is to develop a testing program for mercury and other chemicals specific to Sitka's past.
The history of use of chlorine in the pulp industry will be a legacy. Those compounds are known as persistent. And so unfortunately, when those environments were contaminated, that's going to be for a long time. And we would like to address some of that here, is to see if there's any evidence of those compounds still in the environment and the food web.
O'Hara says the kind of local partnership he envisions has already been successful elsewhere. Tribal peoples and governments from a number of Arctic nations formed an Arctic Monitoring Assessment Program, which has worked effectively to mitigate the hazards of some toxic chemicals.
So I would say it's science-based local empowerment, that you're going to go with data in hand and say, this is what's happening to us, and it's out of our control. It's coming from you guys outside of us.
And what would we monitor in Southeast? O'Hara says that's all part of the proposal to build the capacity among Southeast organizations to make these decisions for themselves. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Well, it is Friday, July the 29th, and that means it's time for our Stocks Report with Dan Berg. He's a financial advisor with Wells Fargo Advisors in Bellevue, Washington, and he's joining us now by telephone. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Angela.
So what's the news this week?
Well, we had lots of news. The markets didn't go anywhere in particular, necessarily, but we had a fairly big move up over the last few weeks, and the markets basically stayed high, which I guess is good news. For economic news here in the U.S. this week, the headliner is the Federal Open Market Committee regarding interest rates. They basically said no hike, and so it probably wasn't headlines on your radio station, but they were saying that the economy is hanging in there and a rate hike is still possible for some time later this year. However, it looks as though the economy did slow during the second quarter. The initial GDP read was only a 1.2 annual rate for the second quarter of this year, which is probably one of the reasons why they didn't hike in the first place. In other economic news, housing and manufacturing are looking a little bit better. There was an initial reading for manufacturing from a company called Market, which does a national survey, and they're showing modest expansion nationally in manufacturing, which is good news. That's been lagging lately due to the strong dollar. And housing continues to be a source of strength for the U.S. economy. The Case-Shiller 20-City Housing Price Index year-on-year for the month of June was 5.2% rise, and the three markets which had the highest price increases in order from the best was Portland, Seattle, and Denver. So Western United States housing looks like it's pretty hot. Overseas, the biggest news is probably Japan. The government a few weeks ago won an election, and they wasted no time in trying to do some stimulus spending. The Japanese government announced a $265 billion spending plan, and we'll see if that might help the Japanese economy get a little bit more momentum. So for the week, the Dow Jones closed down 132 points to 18,432. The NASDAQ did much better, and you'll discover why in just a moment with some of the technology shares. NASDAQ closed at 5,162. That was a 1.2% gain for the week. And the S&P 500 was basically unchanged, closing at 2,173. Some of the big news was outside of the stock market, of course, and the price of oil has been really in a steady fall for the last few weeks. Oil closed today at $41.47 for next week's West Texas contract. That is a full $10 a barrel lower than it was in early June. I looked at my chart, And on the 9th of June, oil was basically saying hello to $52 a barrel. And so I think that will be reflected in the pump. And so far, though, it doesn't seem to be reflected too much in oil company prices, at least not yet. Gold has recovered a bit. Gold recovered to $1,351 an ounce. That was up from $1,323 last week. Regarding the bond market, we had yields come down somewhat on some weaker GDP news this week. The 30-year Treasury is at 2.18, and the 10-year Treasury yields 1.45. Those are still within shouting distance of record lows.
Well, thanks for that information. What can you tell us about individual stocks that you've been keeping your eyes on?
Well, it's really hard to choose where to start here because we had 195 of the S&P 500 companies announcing this past week. But we did have a couple of deals. One deal was that Verizon, the phone company, symbol VZ, is buying the internet operations of Yahoo, which also includes AOL, Yahoo symbol YH00. Verizon closed at $55.14, and Yahoo is at $38.16. Apple announced earnings this week, symbol AAPL. They beat estimates. That closed up nicely this week to $104.16. Google, symbol G-O-O-G, or G-O-O-G-L, depending upon which voting stock you own. It's also known as Alphabet, by the way. That had a very good day today. Their revenue up year-on-year was over 20%, and that closed at $792 a share. Exxon, symbol XOM, announced a loss, which they rarely do for the quarter. Symbol XOM closed at $88.95. McDonald's also had a punk quarter. I guess breakfast all day wasn't quite enough. MCD closed at $117.65. And in Northwest issues, Boeing announced earnings. Symbol BA closed at $133.66. Amazon really crushed earnings. Symbol AMZN closed at $759.50. We have a new closing record for Amazon. Just a little note of interest. For those of you who occasionally pass through Seattle and wonder why traffic is worse than it ever is, and I can tell you why rents are so high downtown Seattle, the Amazon workforce is fully 47% more this year than it was just a year ago. So Amazon has been on a hiring binge of epic proportions to staff their growth. Alaska Air, symbol ALK, closed at $67.22.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Dan, for that update this week. What's on the horizon for next week that we might want to know?
Well, the big news next week, which may have some modest political implications, is the employment situation report, where they talk about jobs gained or lost. At least it's a rough estimate. That's coming out on Friday. And then we have lots of news regarding manufacturing, which has also been in the political news. We get the final market and ISM national surveys and factory orders, and we're modestly optimistic about manufacturing finding some traction, and we'll see if that's true next week.
Okay, well, we'll check in with you again next Friday to find out.
Thank you, Angela.
Okay, take care, Dan.
You bet. Okay, bye.
Dan Berg is a financial advisor with Wells Fargo Advisors in Bellevue, Washington.
Listeners are reminded that the information provided is general in nature and may not apply to their personal investment situation. Individuals should consult with their chosen financial professional before making any decisions. Investment products and services are offered through Wells Fargo Advisors, LLC, member of SIPC. Neither Wells Fargo Advisors nor its financial professionals are legal or tax advisors.
And this wraps up KFSK's Midday Magazine. I'm Angela Denning. Thanks for listening.